I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to another edition of Life Behind Bars. I'm Noah Rothbaum, the Daily Beast half full editor. Joining me as always is my colleague and co-host, David Weinchurch. How are you, Dave?
I'm hanging in there. Yourself?
I am well. I feel like we've been talking a lot about bourbon and American whiskey in the last few weeks, more than even normal for us.
So let's talk about it some more.
Well, maybe we'll just get it all out, but I don't think that's really going to happen. No. I don't want it really to happen. I enjoy our talks quite a bit, and it got to a point with like a lot of things where I'm like, you know what, like this would actually probably make a pretty good podcast. So let's stop talking now and record it so that other people can hear it too.
Yeah, let's give it a try. I mean, it's a topic that it turns out I knew a lot less about than I thought I did.
Yeah.
And the more I look into it, the more I realize, holy Hannah, this thing is complicated.
It kind of feels like we've taken up a layer of like tile in a bathroom only to find another layer of tile. And then under that's another layer. And like, I don't know how many layers we're going to have to go through.
I don't know.
Until we go all the way through that.
I think it's linoleum all the way down.
Maybe you're right. Maybe we're looking for that wood at the bottom finally. It's a big world. And to be honest, most of the knowledge out there and most of what people write about is the modern world of bourbon, right? I mean, that is highly codified. There's regulations, you know, government regulations, you know, kind of governing how, you know, what it needs to be made from, how it, you know, the proof, you know, how it can be aged.
Distilleries have been visited, you know.
Absolutely.
Everything is like out there to be found. It's a knowable world, the modern world of bourbon.
You know, nobody would blame you for thinking that's how it's always been made, right? And I think that's how most of us who know and love bourbon have sort of come into it thinking, okay, like this is how it's made today. And some of these brands have been around for a long time. And we talk a lot about history and bourbon. So it must be how it's always been made. Like these things must be chiseled in stone.
I mean,
I mean, that's
as like a teaser, let's say. We'll get to this in a few minutes, but there's this article that was published by the Louisville Commercial, a paper that no longer exists, on March 14th, 1870, where the author says, "Let's talk about Kentucky whiskey," and says then the methods by which it is produced are known but to few persons outside of a limited number of practical distillers. Even dealers in the article being generally ignorant of the different processes by which it is made. And then he goes on to list the six kinds of whiskey made in Kentucky and in detail, like how they made them. And we don't make those whiskeys anymore.
Almost all of them are.
There's some other stuff we should talk about first, maybe.
That's for like a historian or a journalist. That's when the warning lights start to go off, right? When you find...
Yeah.
You know, you start finding, you know, bits and pieces, threads, you know, mentions in old newspaper articles, you know, books that, you know, obscure books that, you know, now are available through the magic of the internet or Amazon or on, you know, used book sites. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you realize like, wait, like that doesn't really work with our modern idea of what bourbon is or was. And it's, I mean, it's very exciting, right? But it's also kind of terrifying because you realize wow, there's a lot that we don't know, and we often speak in, you know, kind of finite terms, and really, we don't really know still.
It wasn't like that.
Right, and we don't really know, you know, for some of these things, what the answer is. I mean, even, you know, there's a lot of debate, a lot of elaborate theories about who was the first person to make bourbon, where the name comes from, even. We can't even agree on that or have found a definitive source. I mean, there are a lot of detailed analysis of different, it seems that everybody who has written a book on bourbon has a different opinion about these matters.
Some of those opinions are very strongly held.
Yes, and it's not like a jigsaw where it's like, okay, if we just turn one piece, all of these things will now fit together. It's like somebody has like mixed together different jigsaw puzzles and we're trying to make one
image. And half the pieces, you know, there were a lot of dogs in the household and they liked to eat cardboard.
mean, yes. I mean, some of them make more sense than others. And to be honest, you know, when you look back at some of the most interesting and some of our favorite whiskey books, you know, from the Social History of Bourbon by Carol Carson, or Kentucky Bourbon, the Early Years of Whiskey Making by Henry Crowgey, you know, these are things that, you know, people have been debating for decades.
I mean, these are questions that are kind of incapable of being answered, which is why they're still around. It's like, you know, questions about who first made rum in the New World, or, you know, there are lots of questions like that when it comes to history, because a lot of the people who were doing these things weren't doing it and writing down what they were doing. They weren't famous. They were just people doing stuff. That doesn't get chronicled, really.
It kind of reminds me of a story that you did for Half Full a few years ago about all of the research that you had found about the martini, right? It was like an annotated.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, that was a lot of work.
And I think some of these questions, just because we don't know the answer, and I'm not sure if we ever will, doesn't mean that we shouldn't look into them. Because as your story and many of your stories prove, even going down these rabbit holes, if you will, going on these, you know, adventures, looking for more information, yield all types of interesting and unexpected discoveries, you know, that about the world of cocktails.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, you have to, like, you know, lay a trail of crumbs into this stuff. And a lot of people, I think, just dive in looking for the one thing they're looking for.
Right.
And they don't lay the trail of crumbs. And so they find things, but there's no sort of path to that knowledge. And that and it's if you lay those paths, then when you find stuff along the way, and you can find more where it proves to be interesting. Half the time, you don't realize it was interesting until later. And when you get another piece of information, and it's like, whoa, wait a minute, that goes with that. And suddenly, it's really slow work.
Yeah, and even some of the things that we kind of take for granted, like even the idea of, you know, charring the inside of a barrel, like, you know, the regulations now require, you know, a new oak container. I mean, that's the law or the regulation, but which really means like a new oak barrel. And, you know, it's charred and it has to be charred. We think of that as, you know, very American, you know, that this is like, you know, one of the essential pieces of making American whiskey. And
people think of it as being like this kind of frontier thing that, you know, there's a lot of wishful thinking. It's like, oh, they were on the frontier. They were making whiskey. Why did they char the barrels? I don't know. Maybe the barrels had other things in them and they wanted to get rid of the taste. Okay, that's what happened. Well, you know, in fact, like the charring, you find it in scientific journals of the time. It was like the latest in storage technology, and it was, you know, discussed in by very serious scientists and in France and England. And, you know, in America, they read those journals, even on the frontier, and they said, well, why don't we put our whiskey in that?
It's less about who was the first person to char the barrels, but it's more why. And I think the fact that the regulations now require the new oak container, the barrel, to be charred, it's not because of, you know, as we once thought, this sort of homespun theory of like reusing the barrel, but it's more because of the actual properties of the barrel, which was mind blowing to me, because that's, that's accepted fact that it was just either a total accident that they were charred in the first place,
right,
like a lightning strike or something, or that it was because they wanted to get the flavor of like fish out of a barrel, so they burned it. I mean, to be honest, I don't even like cooking fish in my house because the smell is so strong sometimes. And if you really think about it, like if a barrel had been sitting there for months with herring in it, wouldn't the herring have really soaked in? I mean, you could burn that barrel for hours. It would still smell like herring.
I don't really want fish whiskey, I gotta tell you. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't need to fill a barrel with herring and test that theory out.
And you know, if you look in the right places, I mean, there's a book published in the Heart of Rye Whiskey Country in Western Pennsylvania in 1824, where the guy, it's like his encyclopedia of knowledge for farmers basically, and he just comes out and says, you know, if you put a whiskey in a charred barrel, it will improve the flavor and it will give you color very quickly. That's the reason right there.
I mean, was everybody using a char barrel in like the 1800s? Probably not.
Probably not originally, but
right. I mean,
it was a competitive advantage for the people.
Absolutely.
It definitely was.
I mean, I think that's part of it also, is just that now everybody, I mean, there are obviously differences from distillery to distillery and brand from brand, even the different brands that distillery will make, but at least it's all follows the same regulations where back in the day it was wide open. I mean,
should we talk about the six kinds of whiskey in Kentucky?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Which just shows the range of what was going on.
The guy defines them, you know, in this article. Unfortunately, it's anonymous. So number one is,
I wrote it, Dave. I'll admit it. I wrote it back then. I didn't want to put my name on it, but I'm owning up to it.
You did good. I mean, you visited all the distilleries and, you know, I hope you set some barrels aside for some bottles. Absolutely. Evidently old whiskey is worth something these days. So we've got Sour Mash Pure Copper. And that was the name of a style. It wasn't just like random words. And you know, and you see that in ads if somebody's talking about they're selling Sour Mash Pure Copper or Fire Copper whiskey. It's sour mash, so they're going to use some of the spent wash from distilling to mix in with the grain for the next batch and turn it into mash to distill. The mash for the Sour Mash Pure Copper, it was also small tub whiskey. That was another technical term. And we don't use that anymore. Small tub whiskey meant they used whiskey barrels to do the mashing in, individual ones. So, you know, they'd use like 20 or 30 barrels at a time, and that stuff had to be stirred by hand, so it was labor and
the mash is really hot. I mean, it's like
boiling, you know.
Yeah, I remember doing it once with Chris Morris down at Woodford Reserve, and it was, you know, a hot day in Kentucky. The mash is nearly boiling. It is hard work to do that.
It's hard work, especially, you know, you're doing it in the small tubs. I mean, it's crazy. It's a lot of stirring. I've helped to stir at George Washington's distillery when a bunch of distillers years ago did a test batch in a still set up in a field. I was there as the embedded journalist, so that meant I carried water and stirred mash. It's about all I was good for. So you've got sour mash whiskey made in small tubs, and then the pure copper meant it was distilled twice in copper pot stills. You know, we're making pure copper whiskey again in a lot of the micro distilleries. It turns out that's an authentic style, and much later than we think. You know, this is from 1870, and then there's some other technical stuff which is very weird. They use the first distillation to reduce the second distillation sometimes to proof. So it's all very complicated, but it's like a real old fashioned handmade way of doing things. And that was the prestige stuff.
Yeah.
Then you got sour mash log and copper. Log was also a technical term. That meant you used a wooden still, which was what we call today a three-chamber still. There's only one distillery in America that has one right now. And that's the Leopold Brothers in Denver, who had to have one made specially because that hasn't been used since World War II. sort of a semi-automatic type still. It's like a stack of pot stills made out of wood because you're running steam into it. You don't have to worry about burning it up.
Which in itself is crazy. I mean, when I think you had first mentioned this to me in passing a few years ago. And like looking into it, I mean, basically the idea that you're making a still out of wood.
Out of wood.
I had found a news item, obit, recently for a distiller, I think in Illinois, who was killed using one, right? It was too much pressure in the wood, this wooden three-chamber still, and exploded, right? And he was burned.
That's crazy. I mean, it's dangerous. But, you know, every distillery had a cooper on hand at the time.
Right.
So it was a lot cheaper to make your own and use copper only for the, you know, the plates inside that separate the chambers of the still. It sort of works like a stack of pot stills feeding into each other.
And almost built like a stack of barrels, almost like straight barrels.
Yeah. Like one of the big tanks that they blend cognac in, you know?
Exactly.
It's like a big wooden tank that they feed steam in at the bottom and, it boils through the mash and strips out the alcohol.
I mean, just the idea that, like, you know, we always think of a still being made of metal. I mean, just in itself, that the fact that it's wood is really, like, incredible, and that we sort of lost that.
I know.
I mean, that nobody.
Well, I got a
remembers that.
I got a text from a distiller not too long ago, showing me a miniature, like barrel-sized three-chamber still he was building. So we'll see. He's doing a test one in wood.
Wow.
So it's going to happen. I know it's going to happen because it was used for a really long time. It was used for the entire 19th century, and really big brands used wooden stills. The Sour Mash Log and Copper. This guy says, so it goes the first run, you know, where you get like up to about, I don't know, 40% alcohol, 30, 40% alcohol, came out of the, maybe a little higher. It came out of this huge log still or wooden still. And then they would double it in quote, fire copper. So a wood heated copper pot still. So it gets distilled again, kind of like what they do in micro distilleries. And this guy goes on to say, most of the sour mash whiskey made in the state is made on this plan. So it wasn't just some holdouts. This is what people were making.
You and I were looking at an article from 1913. That shows like a horizontal copper doubler used without, like, what it says, the caption is used without vapor pipe or condensing tub in connection with three chamber wooden still. And it almost looks like an early submarine, like the, you know, the Merrimack or the Monitor or something from the Civil War, you know, but made of copper. And that's, you know, that was hooked up to the three chamber wooden still.
They still use that in Canada, by the way, because I've seen them at several very large Canadian distilleries where they call it a pot still.
Hmm.
And it's the doubler, you know, and it comes out of a column still, a huge modern, like steam jacketed 30-foot high column still, but it goes into one of those submarines right there. And it's funny. And that was, you know, that's 100 years old at least. So that technology.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Third kind of whiskey, sweet mash, pure copper. It's the same as the sour mash, pure copper. So it's double pot stills. But instead of sour mash, you make the mash, you grind the grain, and then you pour boiling water on it, not spent mash from the previous distillation. And that makes us, you know, a slightly less complex whiskey, but some people like it. They used a lot of sweet mash for making rye whiskey, for instance, because the sour mash was just a little too funky. Yeah. Rye is already funky.
I was going to say, it's,
yeah.
it doesn't so need it was any like, help there.
Like, yeah, all right, we get it. Funky, enough. Then there's steam copper. where you get rid of all the small tubs and the extra labor, and you do all the mashing in a huge wooden or metal tub with a mechanical agitator, and you heat it with steam injection, and you know, and it's modernized. That uses sweet hop yeast, which is yeast that has a lot of hops in it, and they still use that for making bourbon, and it gives it a little bit of bite in the flavor. The hops, a little bit of hops goes a long way. So this is distilled in a wooden beer still. So the same thing, that wooden column, but no doubler attached. It's doubled separately in a copper pot still. Why? I don't know.
It's like then, every permutation of like,
yeah, distilling. This one he doesn't talk about much. But then there's bourbon steam whiskey, which is the same as the steam copper. So they use a big tub for mashing, but it's got a wooden doubler or thumper attached, which you still see sometimes in Kentucky.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a wooden keg where stuff comes off of this big three chamber still here and goes into a keg where it bubbles through condensed steam, basically, and strips off the alcohol and comes out again. As the guy said, this trade constitutes the bulk of Bourbon County whiskey. So any whiskey made in Bourbon County is made this way. And then there's finally like a higher alcohol stuff that's made with lower grade corn and rye that's made to be redistilled and used in blended whiskey and stuff like that. And he doesn't talk about that much because he's embarrassed of it.
But he says it also put in like uncharred barrels too.
Uncharred barrels, yeah. So used really barrels, in other words, yeah. or uncharred cooperage. They don't need the extra char because it's not going to be sold as whiskey. It's going to be sold as alcohol for redistilling.
I mean, that's a pretty good idea of what was going on, but there's even there are horizontal log stills, you know,
This is only the six kinds. There are probably, if you looked around America, you'd find another eight kinds. There's Tennessee whiskey, which is like the bourbon steam whiskey, big three chamber still, doubled in a wooden or sometimes a copper doubler. But then everything gets filtered through maple charcoal at the beginning. And that filtration goes back way into the 18th century. They were rectifying whiskey with that, with charcoal, in the early 19th century. And it wasn't just Tennessee whiskey, but Tennessee was really into it, and that was their favorite. So it became the style for Tennessee whiskey.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me that at this point, there are really only a couple of stills used in America. I mean, if you take out Todd Leopold's three chamber still out in Denver, I mean, it's basically column still for the most part, which is just a giant tower that can be, you know, 3, 4, 5 stories tall. Right. And I mean, so wide, the ones at Jack Daniels are, I couldn't even put my arms around them. They're so big. Yeah. Right. And there are different plates inside, and each plate is a distillation. And then pot stills, which are used, you know, certainly less commonly than the column stills. And
although, just, you know, the micro distillers brought them back, I mean, in a big way.
Yeah. But by volume, certainly, most of this probably made in the column still kid is so efficient.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, not only do people not use these other types of stills, but we don't even talk about them. You know what I mean? There's no reference. I had never heard of, and I wasn't sure I totally believed you when you told me that stills were made from wood, but it happened.
But it's actually true.
And it was used. I mean, you know, I think, you know, Wayne Curtis recently wrote a story about Todd Leopold and his rye, and a lot about, you know, his story. And as a result, you and I have gone down looking for even more information about three chamber stills. And it's really amazing that they were used through the 30s, like in Maryland and in the Northeast for making rye. And I mean, it's not something that was used 200 years ago. I mean, we're talking about less than 100 years ago and touted in newspaper ads all over the country, you know, for rye whiskey, like made the real way in a three chamber still is basically what the ads say. And those ads run all over. I mean, it's just pretty incredible.
I mean, I think something like 6 years ago, I wrote a big article for the Whiskey Advocate. and that was when I came across all that stuff. And that was Todd Leopold was doing his research at the same time, maybe a little earlier. And, you know, nobody believed any of this. And I finally had to show pictures. You know, I couldn't figure out what made them disappear. Like you said, you know, in the 30s, you see them coming back after Prohibition. People tried really hard to put things back the way they were before Prohibition. And people who made rye especially knew that the three chamber still was perfect for rye, because it kind of gave you a cleaner spirit than a pot still, but it gave rye some texture that you don't get as much on rye with a column still like bourbon switched to. And so they started up again with three chambers. But I think what happened, I know you and I have been doing research on this, and we've come across a bunch of stuff about World War II. It turns out World War II was just as traumatic as Prohibition for the whiskey industry in some ways. Everybody had to shut down and make industrial alcohol. And the people who had three chamber stills couldn't really do that. They couldn't get the stuff up to as high proof as the people who had column stills. So the War Production Board basically put column stills in their distilleries.
You know, it was sort of like a two-part step, right? Because first, yeah, the War Production Board calculated, they had a stock of 550 million gallons of whiskey at the beginning of the war, which they figured would last 4 or 5 years based upon annual consumption rates. So, I mean, yeah. I found all of this, like, you know, I didn't really know about any of this. You know, when I started working on The Art of American Whiskey, my book, that's where I came across all this stuff. And, you know, once we get into World War II, you know, all these distilleries are running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they're supplying alcohol for a range of products.
Yeah, a lot of stuff uses alcohol as the base, explosives, synthetic rubber. There's all kinds of stuff like that.
It makes a lot of sense that, like, you know, the government would want to invest in these distilleries to help them put in new stills and give in, you know, sort of all hands on deck for the war effort, that they could get a still probably made very quickly and put in quickly. So, you know,
I mean, they were scouring around even for like used pieces, just anything, so they didn't have to produce new stuff. Yeah. You know, it was really interesting. There was a whole lot of testimony that was given about this in 1942 and 43. And I mean, it's really interesting for the history of whiskey. Just you see the need to do this stuff, but at the same time you see kind of a lot of diversity in whiskey making dying right there. It just was not good for the war effort, and everybody had to be geared towards that.
And by the time that the war is over, I mean, it's 25 years since the beginning of Prohibition, right? So you know, over those 2.5 decades, you know, the whiskey industry has only worked semi-normally for a few years before, you know, they have to shut down again for the war. So, you know, if we stopped making something today and picked it up again in 25 years, like, no wonder a lot of stuff was lost. And you have all these new production methods because of the war, and, I mean, which, you know, obviously transform a lot of different industries, everything from, you know, furniture, you know, all of the mid-century modern and all the Eames, you know, designs that make use of all these new techniques for bending wood and making plastics and stuff. And I mean, you should see it over and over again.
Like the technology they'd used to make PT boat hulls.
Exactly. You know? Is now making, you know, a beautiful, you know, living room chair. But it's a weird thing. And obviously the whiskey industry is not immune. And then you have all these other effects of people, you know, all the GIs, you know, going to Europe and the Caribbean, and, you know, as whiskey gets, even despite the war board's projections, ever more scarce during the war, people are drinking rum and other things. And it's no wonder, you know, when this is all over, that what they're making and what people want is different than what they were making and what they wanted to drink, you know, before Prohibition started.
When it came out of World War II, the whiskey industry, you know, they were gun shy. They were like, okay, hey, we're going to use column stills, because if they shut us down again, you know, at least we'll be able to make money on industrial alcohol. And at the same time, you know, they had some stocks of whiskey left that had been aging, but they had to stretch it out as much as possible because, you know, if they sold it all, it would be gone and then they'd be out of business. So suddenly you see blended whiskey and lots of blended whiskey coming in and using that industrial alcohol that they'd learned to make. I mean, the biggest industrial alcohol producer in the United States was the Publicker Company of Philadelphia, their distillery there. And they were known for Rittenhouse rye whiskey was theirs. That was their brand.
And not to be confused that like American blended whiskey is very different than blended Scotch whiskey.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, or
blended Canadian for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, generally in America, it is
neutral spirit. The stuff they use in Scotland and Canada is grain whiskey, which is just a little bit richer and has to be aged. It's one of the reasons why Canadian whiskey basically ate the American whiskey's industry's lunch in the 1960s, 70s, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, is because their whiskey was actually better.
Yeah, ours was, it's basically straight whiskey blended with neutral grain spirit.
You could make it easily by taking a bottle of vodka and a bottle of bourbon, or two bottles of vodka and a bottle of bourbon to be more realistic, pouring them together in a jug and then putting a little caramel color in until it looks like whiskey, because that's exactly how it was made.
And you see like a lot of brands go from straight, or what people knew as straight whiskey before the war, before prohibition, mm-hmm. and they're now become blends, right? And there's a lot
it's not whiskey. Like the manufacturers were trying to pull a fast one. They didn't really have a choice.
And whiskey drinkers knew. I mean, it wasn't like people realized like, oh, like this is not okay. Like this tastes different. Like
David Embury talks about that.
You know, I was just thinking that he's some very choice words about brands moving there for production from, you know, I think from Kentucky to the Midwest, you know, and turning their brands into blends. But, you know, like many periods in American whiskey history, once the brands are able to get a few years of production under their belt and put away whiskey and age it, the blends go away. I mean, or they become very secondary.
But a lot of that is sales that would never go back to whiskey,
right?
Until very recently, you know.
Yeah,
a lot of people just said, as long as if I'm going to be drinking vodka, I might as well drink vodka.
Why people switch to say, you know, blended Scotch whiskey, you know, because it was certainly a lot more flavorful and richer. So you know, at that point, we kind of get in many ways into the modern era, and that is familiar territory, but
that we understand. I think from World War II and before, way weirder than than I had understood.
Yeah, and in many ways, you know, again, I think more complex and more corporate in certain ways. You know, and there are a lot of factors, you know, figuring in, you know, to it's being made, and a lot of those things have just, you know, sort of been streamlined out of the story of bourbon, you know. I'm not, you know, over the years.
And I mean, I sure would like to go back to Kentucky in 1870 and taste those six kinds of whiskey, you know.
Yeah. Get Todd Leopold working on a few other
I think we got to get him going on bourbon projects. Steam maybe, or or sweet mash pure copper, you know.
Yeah, for sure. He's to build a whole museum
small tub mashing. Get all the bartenders to come out and stir.
We may be constricted into this bourbon force. So for the sake of bourbon, I'm willing to give it a try. So as two people who write and, you know, about bourbon American whiskey fairly often, it is a little terrifying to realize that, like, you know, you didn't know the whole picture, and we probably won't ever know the whole picture.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, kind of like, to the best of our knowledge, this is our understanding today, but you know, it's exciting because I think there are many other layers and many other weird things that we're going to find, and then the pieces start to come into focus and fit together the right way.
That's the rich part of life, you know. I kind of like it better this way, you know. It's like I'm always going to find something that's going to blow my mind. I clink my glass containing I guess it's basically steam copper whiskey or bourbon steam is the closest that it comes. And
exactly.
I've got no complaints with it.
Me either, but we will toast our predecessors and the history of bourbon today. Cheers.
Cheers.
Dave and I encourage you to drink responsibly always.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.